This is the Propanon Podcast. Tune in.
Open your fucking ears, jackass.
Ethan Persoff is an American cartoonist, archivist, and cutting-edge sound artist based out of Austin, Texas. I first learned about Ethan through his work as an archivist after he digitized and webified the complete run of Paul Krassner's pioneering countercultural magazine, The Realist. During the course of writing my book, Chapel Perilous, The Life and Thought Crimes of Robert Anton Wilson, Ethan's digitization became an invaluable resource and wealth of information that I kept returning to again and again. And as a cartoonist, he's the co-author of the visually appealing book John Wilcock, The New York Years. Wilcock was the creator of The Village Voice, another pioneering countercultural magazine that changed the course of American history. Ethan's most recent work includes the book and record, The Recovery of Charlie Pickle, as well as his sound art, which is super interesting and really fun to listen to. I had a blast talking with Ethan. We talked about his work, the work it took to digitize The Realist on the web. We talked about his John Wilcock book, 1960s counterculture in general, obscenity laws, media technologies, Tijuana Bibles, and the importance of remaining subversive. What a blast it was speaking with Ethan. For everyone who wants to check out his work, I recommend going to his website, ep.tc. So without further ado, Ethan Persoff.
Yeah, man. Oh, dude, so you were, the Wilcock book came about through your work on the Realist archive when you
yes,
did part of yeah. the digitization. Okay.
Yeah. So basically I became friends. I had a couple cool things online and elsewhere, and I became friends with Paul Krassner, and that was fucking terrific. And he trusted me with I have a website that doesn't really, you know, it's got a bunch of really weird stuff on it, but the most impacting is this section called Comics with Problems, and I think Paul liked it. Not sure, but he trusted me and he allowed me to put all the Realist up there. Yeah. I mean, I kind of think actually working on Paul's Realist archive was brought about by Robert Anton Wilson, but, cause I started it right after, Ra had died. Mm-hmm. Never got to meet him or talk with him. I feel a little sad about that, but anyway, I was working on the Realist for a long time and got it done and mentioned how much I was enjoying one of the writers from it, which was John Wilcox stuff.
Mm.
And lo and behold, John and I are talking, and this guy in his 80s suddenly decides we were talking about doing a biography comic, and he's just like, all right, I'll stop by. And I'm in Austin. He's in Ojai, California. He just drives straight out the door, shows up in Austin. We figure out a timeline, and it was just the coolest opportunity to meet somebody who had been that was John's role in pushing culture around.
Mm.
And he just wasn't given his due although he did get, I think near the end of his life, he started to get due again. You get undone. You get your due, get undone, and get a do-over or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, second do. So kind of
you do up. Yeah,
you do.
Yeah, some people. Yeah, but if you do constant do, you become like empty, like duped.
You get duped. A big empty can of duped.
Yeah. Mountain duped.
So you mentioned how John is, you know, this kind of engine of the counterculture in many ways, right? So where did he get his start?
It's pretty cool. He co-founded the Village Voice in a very funny way, but he actually got his start working for a bunch of British tabloid papers in the 50s and 40s, and he moved to Canada and he became an interviewer of a bunch of Hollywood people, and then he decided to move to Greenwich Village in 1954 when it was probably exciting, you know. Mm-hmm. You talk about, like, can you imagine, you can't have, there's no chance, I think, for small cities or small communities to exist anymore, because people, this sounds again like tech complaint, but they just put their cities out. If I was like, what is Greenwich Village like right now? I would just go and I would find a bunch of permanent web cameras. I would find a bunch of people doing stories. I could virtually download it onto my, you know, VR headset and walk mm-hmm. around in it. You know, yeah, I can, you know, because there's like a YouTube VR channel right now where you can just upload like three dimensional, you know, experiences and stuff. And our brains don't know that that is not real.
Mm.
But in terms of actually going to Greenwich Village in the 40s or 50s and risking being in that place, you know, being maybe not surviving in that space. You know, maybe your brain doesn't survive because somebody cuts you down in a certain way, or maybe you fall into hard drugs, or I don't know, maybe you don't like the way it smells. Maybe somebody thinks you're an uptight asshole and tells you to get the fuck out. You don't access that town, or you're brought into it and it, you know, you're in this small village, literally. I mean, what is it, like 7 fucking square blocks or something? It's very small, and you incubate and Bob Dylan pops out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, but
I mean, as do so many others as well.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, yeah,
all the way up through the 90s, even, I'd say, right, when artists kind of, they knew that the village was the place to go to kind of like pop off.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. There used to be East Village Radio, which was really cool too, which was just like a radio station on the sidewalk there. But
great radio station. Yeah, I mean, it's in on the Bowery.
Right? Okay, which is even crazier, which mm-hmm. is even more insane history. Mm-hmm. You know, and I've got like a friend who's in his 70s or 80s now, and he was actually homeless in the Bowery in the 60s, and he has some incredible stories that are like frightening. But the history of that thing going back to whenever, I don't know, 20s or 30s or wild stuff. I don't know.
Yeah,
I've never been to the Bowery, so I don't, so I would have to download it from my YouTube.
Yeah, you would need to look at only virtual. You can only look at virtual reality, augmented reality of the Bowery back then. Today,
condos now.
Bowery is amazingly. Well, I don't know if that's the right word for it, but yeah, it's completely like shiny. You know, luxury condos have like totally blown up right when you get off the bridge. You know, right into Manhattan, right there. It's wild how things just shift and change, like the physical environment just totally shifts and changes. You know what I mean? Like
money. And now people expect it to be, you know, I don't know. I have some criticisms about the current culture. Like now somebody's like, well, I'm going to complain about it online if I don't have a good experience somewhere. Mm. And I have power as like an online speaker. No, it's so much better to fucking be like, this shit is unfair. You know, fuck you. And I'm just going to like be okay with it and adjust to it. But I'm going to grow as a fucking human and go through my problems. This shit is unfair. Yes, that is so much better than like, I'm going to tell on you. You know, we have a bunch of infants. It does, the more I'm thinking about it, fuck it. This generation is fucked. You know, nuke them. But there's nuke 'em.
Well, it's a hard moment, right? I mean, is this because as we're growing and dealing with life, you know, and the chaos of life as you know, it's still a struggle to like get a grip, and things are more chaotic than ever, right? And so the thought of like, I mean, I remember when I think back to being like a youngin or whatever, there was only a few that were out there doing the stuff that I thought was cool then too, you know? So there's always that sort of segment of the population that all age groups that just seem to be total idiots. You know what I mean? Yeah. So the temptation is to look at them, at the idiots, and think that they're representative of the whole group. You know what I mean? Like, they're struggling to come to grips with this new turn in the media that, you know, it's so weird. It was more tactile. We had to be physically there. It was word of mouth, and you had to, but now it does seem like you could just virtually upload what it was like back then, you know, but there's something missing, you know, that certain quality is missing, you know?
Yeah. You know, you make a fantastic point. I might be duped. I might not be seeing it because I'm just like seeing like these things and frustrated by it and thinking that that's I might be out of the loop. There might be a fantastic secondary subculture that is just there and they're operating with their own rules and everything. Yeah, you make a very good point. It's something to think about too. I wonder. I mean, there's a couple things. One, I don't think kids read. And I don't mean to be a dick, but like that's a fucking big one, you know. Like people are proudly stupid, you know. Like somebody will post something, they'll be like, "What's a book?" You know, and everyone's like, "Ha ha ha," you know. It's pretty fucking tough to read, you know. Because you have no cues too, you got to wade through it. But okay, so speaking of reading, so yeah, John came to New York in the 50s and he basically had an idea for a community newspaper, which became the Village Voice. And so it was sort of his idea that there be local reporting, and hyper-local reporting was sort of one of his contributions to our world, right? And he kind of got fucked over by Norman Mailer and other people related to the Village Voice.
They all co-founded it together, right? It was,
well, yeah. So he basically put up a postcard in a bookshelf in a bookstore saying, with the idea for the Village Voice. Can you imagine how funny it would be if somebody just was like, go back to like 2001, 2002, somebody goes into a bookstore and goes, looking to create YouTube, contact me if interested, right? And so what would happen? A couple of wealthy people would contact him, you know, and they would be known as like the founders of YouTube. But he'd be like, well, I put the fucking thing up. And they're like, well, we paid for it. So now we're YouTube and we're going to sell it to Google. And yeah, you can tell people that you fucking had a role in it, but you know, it's our money. So that, you know, that's the unfair truth that continues forever.
Is that what happened with Wilcox?
It's exactly
what Mailer did.
Yeah. There was, they got one writer from The Nation to help with them. Dan Wolf. And then it was Ed Fancher and Jerry Talmer, had a little money, and Norman Mailer had a little money, and they, you know, they bought the paper. And so it was like their paper. And so, and John was a nosy person, and he had a really cool column called The Village Square, which basically was even more hyper local and pretty damn funny. He walked around the village and like, that would be his column. So it'd be, you know, some like one column might be, you know, I don't know, like a bunch of people were playing hopscotch outside. Who won? Let me know, you know, and or something like that. But they would also have a political bent to it. And he also would throw parties constantly and connect a lot of people in the village through these parties. And then he left.
Was he living in the village at that time?
Yes, he was. And then he became, did you say he didn't download it from the internet?
Is that what I'm saying, do you, where in the village was he living?
He had two apartments. I can't recall the, oh shoot. The bookstore was on Sheridan Street, but I can't remember anything. I think it was adjacent.
Nice. Yeah. I just like to get a mental map in my head. You know,
Was that enough to help you out or
not really?
Yeah. I'm terrible at it.
All good.
Yeah. When my wife met me, she, was surprised that I thought Helsinki was an Asian city. I'm terrible at that. That's where the internet's great. You can find literally a map for anything on the internet.
Yeah.
Very, very, that's a dope part of the internet. But so John's biography sort of goes from the Village Voice into trying out all these different ideas on really wild papers. Like we mentioned, East Village Radio, that kind of comes from East Village Other in a way.
Okay.
At least spiritually. And East Village Other was like the real breakout fucking weird paper, you know, all sorts of cartoonists, all sorts of really crazy writers. And he helped with that. And then he also,
and that was 1965, right? He
sounds right.
Started. Yeah. Cause that's one of really the first, what gets termed the underground newspaper. That's kind of like, would you say that was the original?
It's certainly the realization of a lot of ideas. and a bold kind of, you know, the beginning of including like Black Panther stuff on a cover, you know, things. So just trying out things, like, you know, there were certain changes in obscenity law that made it a lot easier to used to be that if you printed the word fuck, you would get, that book would get, you know, deemed inappropriate and illegal because there was no moral use of the word, you know. Mm-hmm. Times changed, thankfully, to the point where you could, you know, print and discuss sex in a more candid way and even print pictures of it. So the Tijuana Bibles kind of left, and we suddenly had, you know, really weird papers that start emerging in the late 60s, like Screw and a bunch of other things. And the 70s are just full of pornography, you know, on newsprint pornography. It's really funny to look at that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Like the underground newspapers.
Yeah, but they became very, very explicit, or, you know, any paper wanted to do whatever it wanted. New York had the Rat. Austin had other people that it had the Rag, but it also sort of contributed to the Rat, and that the same person, Jeff Shiro, was a part of both papers. There were a bunch of cities that had them. And so the comic, it took me 50 minutes to tell you what this is. The comic basically is a retelling of that I drew with Scott, and gives some chronology to most of those papers, John's role in it. And he also participated in it right until he died, which was great. So it's also, you know, relatively fact-checked, and it has his consent, and it was the last big project that he was on before he died. So that was really important to me.
Heck yeah, man. It's a great project, man. And, you know, to definitely, it's the role that you've placed yourself in as being like a very, like, you know, noble and needed one right now, because you're so aware of like the influx of information that's just like flooding everyone, and we're caught in this, yeah, like prison of now in a way. And like,
yeah, how do you give a shit about anything right now,
you know?
Yeah, so that's been my problem.
But you're doing it though, bro. Like you've
well, thank you.
Yeah,
that makes you feel good. Thank you, buddy.
Yeah, especially hearing the story of, it seems like it's a dual story, obviously, right? But and Wilcox's role in the underground newspaper movement, how that was such a huge thing of that counterculture, and then how things, it in many ways it was the forerunner to what the techno utopians of the 90s thought the internet was going to be.
Yeah, that's, you know, great.
Like this whole notion of decentralized nodes, and everyone communicating, you know, across the borders, whatever, to forward this sort of ethos that the 60s counterculture seemed to be a big part of their whole thing, at least retrospectively. You said though, it's to hear the all these things that have been taken for granted for so long, like that there even were obscenity laws that prevented the word fuck being in print, you know. Yeah. And then the whole pushback from the counterculture, that was such a huge part of the counterculture in the early 60s, and they won that one, you know. But now here we are today with in the last number of years with the idea of censored speech, and
well, now we're self-censoring. We're telling people to not say shit.
Okay.
And the government doesn't have to do anything.
We'll break that down. Like, what do you mean? Like,
it's just like we've become fools. Like, it doesn't matter. You know, if somebody said something like offensive at one point, that was their foolishness to do. But it's like, but it doesn't. It shouldn't. Me trying right now just even describe like the dynamic between two obscure people in two different cities, and realizing that I said, you know, two guys, I have in an interest in caring about everybody, because I'm a very, I mean, it's one of the most disingenuous things you can ever say, but I'm a very empathic person. What if somebody ever
says, people person?
Yeah. Yeah. People are like, you're full of shit. But I mean, I try to be sympathetic and caring. And I know that that's really important to people right now is to, well, you know, even in an idea, there must be, you know, something, you know, there must be a decorated collection of people.
For sure. But that
expectation makes me have to reconfigure my fucking ideas.
Mm.
And it also gives like a certain specialness to certain groups that other groups don't have. And then they can, you know, and unfortunately it just fucks the whole damn thing up. You should be able to earn your space by your ideas, not by, I am frustrated when I'm, but basically the jump was that you were talking about censorship. The government doesn't need to censor us right now.
Mm-hmm.
We're censoring ourselves. You know, we're fighting about how you talk about something. So nothing's getting said,
you know,
and you don't see that right now. The thing that's most dangerous is if I was a young punk, I'm seeing a lot of punks jump into the fucking GOP. You get to have a fucking party being like a, you know, being a Republican right now. Nobody's giving you shit the way you talk, you know. That's dangerous because that's the devil, you know, being the Republican. But and I should have a right to say that and not have like some Republican then shame me, be like, hey, you know, you're misrepresenting me, calling me the devil. I'd be like, all right, fuck, I think you're the devil, you know. But the thing that worries me is, well, okay, so with, I don't mean this to be a rant on social media or anything, but it does follow the same trend that happened to underground papers. And so that is, if I have any value in keeping those things around, it's that you can see that predictable trend with people, is that Rolling Stone is a great example. It becomes one thing and it defines how it looks, right? Mm-hmm. So Rolling Stone said, no, it's a glossy paper. It's got all these fucking photographs, very expensive photographs. And it's got all this advertising. And so you're not going to be able to make a Rolling Stone, kid. You know, you can make a zine, which was the natural organic shift from underground papers. And that was awesome. The zine movement was incredible. But
that really popped off like in the 80s. Yeah.
Yeah, 80s, 90s, but the same thing is like, now you can get famous online. You can become an influencer.
Yeah.
You can become a 9-year-old motherfucking influencer. You have no life experience and you're a fucking influencer. You have no ideas, but you're like, I don't know, you got a nice ass or something, or you put on clothes, or you're like trying on this balm. You're suddenly a content creator. They've ruined the word content creator.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've ruined the concept of influence. It's the same way the 80s destroyed the word awesome. It was like awesome. Awesome's a pretty magnificent word, right?
It's a wonderful word.
Yeah, radical is
this day.
Yeah, radical is a great word. Radical, to be radicalized is like exciting. But no, it's just, you know, surf people like destroyed radical. Radical. I don't know where I'm going with that. But with Rolling Stone, it basically killed the paper because and that's what social media has done. It's killed the internet. It's like, no, the internet is a stream of shit with a bunch of like buttons, a bunch of view counters, and it's one fucking, you know, constant sewage of thing. You're never going to spend like a day at a website enjoying this private bookstore of information, you know?
Not anymore.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know. It was good while it lasted. I was one of the first websites in. I'll be one of the last ones out. And I refuse to redesign it too. Fucking deal with it. Go to my website, figure it out, you know?
Well, speaking of websites, man, let's get into what you did with The Realist, because that is amazing. Because during the writing of my book about Wilson, having all the whole
negative
library
thinking.
Right there on the web, like so amazingly accessible, and it looks so cool. Like the design of the website looked cool. It really grabbed the, you know, felt like that era, you know.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. That's exactly what I wanted to do. Yeah. In fact, that was the goal. So I also wanted to read it. And so that was the only way that I would be able to read every issue of The Realist, is if I was scanning it in and checking it out and everything. And I didn't even know. So I only wanted one thing from the realist, and that was to get Paul's okay to put the Disney orgy image up. I wanted that on the web, which is issue 74 of the realist, and it's Wally Wood's depiction of all the Disney characters having sex. It's a very famous image.
Speaking of Tijuana Bible.
Yeah, it is the Tijuana Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Also, artist for EC Comics, also a definite badass. There are a couple of comic book badasses. He's one of them.
That's awesome.
And I wanted very much to put that up. And I was, you know, the thing with the Disneyland Memorial Orgy is that if somebody puts it up right now, Disney can come after them. But if Paul wanted to put it up where they ignored suing him over it because they didn't want to cause attention to it. So Paul basically, through lapse of time, or he was able, statute of limitations, he was able to quasi own that copyright on that without Disney being able to give him shit. So I was interested in adding that to the web. There's a couple things that I've added to the web that I think have really contributed well to culture, which makes me suspicious of, you know, a 17-year-old content creator or something, you know, or whatever, where I'm like, well, prove it, man. Mm-hmm. You don't fucking, you know, let time, don't, okay, if you really care about your fucking ideas on the web, don't put your face on it. I don't care about how you look. Just put your fucking work up, you know. Mm-hmm. But people, I don't know, that's where I get cranky. And I bet you, if we have a recap interview in like 5-10 years, I'll be two things: more pissed off about it and more right. You know, this will be brought to us by Colgate, you know, or some weird kind of thing. Like, we won't even be able to communicate on Zoom without ads coming by.
Oh, but lovely.
Yeah, look forward to it. Your music is going to be, yeah, your music is going to have like jingles in it, where it's like,
you know, I don't know. My music has gotten taken down by YouTube. I've had two videos taken down by YouTube so far.
Good job.
Yeah. Yeah, one
for,
was
for like some streaming trap, and basically like you have content that you're looping in there or something like that. Or,
well, I took a lot of found footage for the videos, right?
That's it. So,
and but it was like, one was it was too violent. It was too much violent imagery at one time, and yeah. It was you know, I sent a video sampled like a Cronenberg movie, Sylvester Stallone Over the Top. That's his arm wrestling movie.
Oh yeah,
pretty classic.
He breaks a guy's arm when he's, or is that the one where like an arm gets broken during? Like,
that's actually Cronenberg, The Fly, another arm wrestling moment.
Oh yeah,
arm wrestling seems to be a theme in this. But yeah, they took that down. They said it was up there for like 8 years. And
DMCA is well, 8 years. You should, by statute of limitations, been able to, like, they didn't catch it.
Yeah, but, they like, had they
that were, law doesn't exist.
Not anymore, man. Then that one was about, well, one of them was about, one of the songs was about, like, the other video they took down was about the phenomenon of how the FBI has set up patsies for utilizing confidential informants to set up patsies for, you know, terror campaigns or whatever, or bombing. Sure. So the 1993 World Trade Center bombing was actually all kind of set up by a confidential informant who, and a bunch of FBI guys. And then the last minute, the confidential informant called the FBI and was like, you guys should probably stop this. They're actually going to really do this. Wow. And they let it, well, I don't want to say they let it happen or whatever, but things happened. And in 1993, the World Trade Center did get bombed, you know? And there was a great book I kind of based the whole video around. It was this book called The Terror Factory. And it's kind of all about how the one way that the FBI has maintained its budgets for counterterrorism has been to sort of, you know, keep the kettle hot. And, you know, it happened a lot with a lot of Muslim kids during the early, you know, the tens of the 2000s, you know, like when that became the huge phenomenon, the Muslim terrorist extremist, you know, a lot of people got set up by confidential informants, you know. And I made the argument in the video that they were doing it to just justify like bloated budgets, you know. And but YouTube, it was an awesome video, man. Like, I sampled like a video sampled Die Hard, you know. Like, the video,
well, I mean,
was,
you, Yeah, your
Great.
references are unfortunately probably protected by a lot of money, so that does suck. That sucks,
They
though.
took
But
that one down.
fair use though, suggests that you should be able to use that stuff.
Yeah,
You
they
know.
took it, but it was very, it was the timing was interesting because it had been up for like a number of years, but and the whole subject matter was that. I mean, it was a really, it was rooted in a radical kind of critique of what had actually happened, right? But it was all around the time of kind of the January 6th stuff.
Yeah.
And when it came out that the governor of Michigan, that the whole plot of these guys to kidnap her, that got foiled, that there was a number of FBI guys in on that, you know? So it touched on these uncomfortable things, but that was the music I came up on. Like people who would just, you know, from Zack de la Rocha to freaking Joe Strummer to all of punk rock to all of hip hop, it would be like point the finger and make a song. But yeah, now it's gone. It's off of YouTube. You can't
And you
watch.
know, I'm one, I'm sorry that happened to you. And two, I bet
Thanks, man.
you and it's awesome that it was up for a while. And I bet you and somebody who's learned from your work or is whatever, they're gonna be hesitant to like go full blast on something because it might get pulled down by Google, you know?
Maybe.
And so it's like versus putting it into a cassette and putting it into mail order and you just send it around. Maybe it's going to take forever to fucking like get that tape into people's hands or DVD or whatever. But there's no way that somebody could press a button and make their DVD at their house disappear. You know, but they can from the streaming server, certainly they can from their Dropbox account and whatever. I mean, there's a limitation in terms of like I know for a fact that I've gotten busted on like certain streaming services for, you know, using any just I'm so nervous to even mention that. But like, you know,
Right,
I'm
I know.
mentioning it, like I don't want to mention. Yeah, but I've gotten stuff
Yeah.
down for like for sampling incorrectly, and it changes the creative process because you want those hits and stuff, and it's very stupid. It's unfortunate. But like yeah, I mean, like Google is more has is the FCC is harmless compared to Google now. The FCC would just fine you or something, but Google can like demonetize you. Like I got friends who have a really successful channel and that's their fucking life. They gotta fucking smile and, you know, for lack of a, I mean, this is probably an off-color way of saying it, but they gotta be like, hey Manny, you know, they gotta fucking Al Jolson their themselves like into a big grin and it's, I don't know. I don't mean to sound so upset because I'm actually very proud of the work I do and very
Yeah,
happy.
it's
I'm
great
very
work.
happy with the world too. The world is pretty beautiful.
But
But
you
like,
raise very poignant critiques though of where it is at in terms of like the communication technologies that we use, because you're very tuned into that, like the mediums that have been used to move the message along. Like you discovered your the photocopy machine, you
oh
know,
my
like
God. Yeah.
the part of the underground press movement was like the lithograph revolution, that now there were these new printing machines and paper available that could print these things up quicker and get the message out there. And it all seemed to coalesce, like, you know, all, some of these counterculture people, even Robert Anton Wilson, a bit of a techno utopianist, you know, maybe a lot of a techno utopianist, this thought that, you know, there would be this moment where all this decentralized information being shared would take down the borders and the boundaries, and there would be equal footing, and it would help bring about an egalitarian situation. But like, it's become very, the turn in the media has kind of this creeping turnkey totalitarianism about it, right?
Yeah,
It's a very scary moment, you know?
I see your, I completely agree with you. I see a timer here at 5 minutes. Let's see if I could.
Right.
So let me quickly. Okay, I'm gonna focus.
Awesome.
One, the thing with the realist that was terrific was finding all the different things that were important to people that were in those issues. And the first community that came to me was the Robert Anton Wilson people once they found out that I was going to do all these issues because all that negative thinking stuff, those I'm so glad it helped you and I'm glad that you responded to it in the way that it was intended to actually not digitize, not like copy the text and just represent it in a different way. No, you want to I wanted it to look like the pages. And it was really cool to get to go through those things with Paul for, you know, in time, and then get to know Paul in a really direct way, and just learn sort of what it is to know one of those people, you know. And that was an amazing experience. I do wonder what Robert Anton Wilson would think of this period, but it's I don't know. It took a long time to get those issues up, and it was a wonderful experience. I keep on wanting to elaborate more, but yeah, I mean, it took like four years.
Wow.
I had to find every fucking issue. Paul had a very limited amount of the early issues. And I don't know, there was a communication style, the way that he wrote an email, that was absolutely unique, in a way to learn something. And so I think there's a certain measure of ageism in the world right now, where people don't want to learn from old people. It's like the only prejudice that people hate. It's like the only prejudice that isn't really being checked right now in terms of like this stuff is age, you know? And if you were to tell like somebody who's like really, really satisfied about the canceling that they're doing, is somebody, you're going to wake up, you know, tomorrow, 82, unable to get an erection, or like with a sagging female body or whatever, they would be like, ah, they wouldn't go, hey, you defend old people. They would immediately be like, oh, that's fucking scary. Don't do that.
Yeah, they're not going to have those perky McCain tits.
Yeah. You ain't going to get those from me. And so, I mean, people get prejudice. That's their prejudice, is age. And so for me, it's like the realist, John Wilcock. I got to work with Evergreen Review, with Barney Rossett. These people are fucking like, they created this world. And so it's been, but people are, you know, you become invisible the older you get. Mm-hmm. And so I think, I don't know. But you keep them in, you keep it in queue, you keep it in the air that this stuff exists. And so I got the realist out, and it had a funny, I'll give you a funny gotcha. You mentioned January 6th, a lot of alt-right people read the realist that I put online. And I, in fact, a lot of alt-right news sources, came from people who suddenly, I'm forgetting his fucking name. I don't care. He can die. He died.
We don't need to know his name.
Yeah. Anyway, he came out being like, I'm a fan of Abbie Hoffman. And he, and Paul Krassner ended up interviewing him for Playboy right before he died. And he was like, told him how much he loved the website, the realist thing. And so I was like, well, great. So, okay. I kind of gave partial access and birth to the alt-right, but that's what happens when you send an idea out. That's what happens when your side is like rejecting intentionally offensive. The realist was intentionally offensive. It was playfully offensive. If you found, if you fell for it, it was a success, you know? And it played with tropes and all these other things.
They were trolling in a way.
Yeah, totally trolling. You know? Like king trolling, king troll.
All right. Yo, thank you again to Ethan Persoff. And please be sure to check out his work on his website, ep.tc. And also, don't forget to check out my new book, Chapel Perilous, The Life and Thought Crimes of Robert Anton Wilson. And that's about it for now, folks. So if I don't speak to you before we head into 2025, may you have a great new year, and let's get ready for the ride. Until then, Gabriel Kennedy, Propanon, signing off.
You've been listening to the Propanon Podcast on the fucking internet.